Hi, it's Wayne Dyer.
Yes.
Hi, it's Bill Bolster from the Edge in Minneapolis.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good.
Thank you for agreeing to this interview.
Oh, okay.
Did I call you Wayne?
Wayne is fine.
Okay. This, of course, is regarding your visit in April in Minneapolis. And the headline on your ad promoting the visit reads, "There's a spiritual solution to every problem."
Right.
And I'm reminded of H.L. Mencken's quote, "For every difficult and complex problem, there's a solution that is easy, simple, and wrong." And I know you like H.L. Mencken.
I do.
How does one begin the process of finding a spiritual solution to a problem?
Well, I think one does it by recognizing that problems are only things that exist because of the way we process our lives and everything that happens in our world. And if we learn to process it in a different way, I always think of everything in terms of energy now.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's like problems represent living in a room of low energy. And when you bring higher energy to the presence of lower energy, it dissolves. It dissipates and it can't survive. And what we just say, that's why I based this book, the second half. I don't know, have you seen the book?
Which one?
There's a Spiritual Solution to Every Problem.
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be why. That's a book that's out on, and is based upon the prayer of St. Francis, where he says, "Where there is darkness, let me show light, let me bring light." The assumption behind that is that, where there is hatred, let me bring love, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
In each one of those lines, I've made a chapter in the second half of the book. And what he's saying there is that darkness is a lower energy than light, and when you bring light to the presence of darkness, you don't have to warn it, you don't have to announce to it, you don't have to tell it that it has to go away. It can't survive. Light dissolves the darkness, and so does love dissolve hate, and so does joy dissolve sadness, and so does faith dissolve doubt, and so on. And once we begin to put our problems into that context of an energy, and that the slowest, lowest energies in the world are the energies of the world of the solid world, where everything that we call problems exists. And if we can bring something called spiritual energy to the presence of that, which is love, kindness, forgiveness, and so on, we can dissolve it. And it's really just a matter of changing our mind about how we're going to process the events of our lives.
So it's just a matter of perhaps looking at problems as opportunities or even gifts?
Well, I think, in the Course of Miracles, I have a display quote for this book that says, you don't have any problems, though you think you do. And I think we the Course teaches us that these things that we call problems are just our ways of processing things in our lives. In the opening line of the Torah, or in the opening line of the Old Testament, Genesis, it says, in the beginning God created heaven and earth. And then 31 lines later it says, and all that God created was good. So if God created everything, and everything that God created was good, bad, and disease, and disharmony, and disorder, and all the things that we call problems, are really something that can't exist, except in our mind, when we separate ourselves from God.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I think we've done. We reconnect ourselves to God. Second, I've got a sort of a family emergency that I felt why I was late today. That's why I've got to. Can you hold just one second?
Sure.
And like a death in the family. Close to a death in the family, and that's where I was. I was on my way out to the airport.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it's there's a lot of things going on right now.
Okay. Well, I'll hurry up.
So I'd like you to get a copy of A Spiritual Solution to Every Problem. I think a lot of the questions that you have will be answered in that.
Okay, well, I also, because this is a question and answer, even though I may know some of the answers, I still want to...
Yeah, I understand.
Right. So really, this is a matter also, is it of reframing problems to see opportunities for growth?
Right, I think I wouldn't even call them problems. I think reframing, anything that occurs in our life and see it in terms of, I always think of it and see it in terms of what kind of energy am I bringing to it? Am I putting my attention on what I don't want,
mm-hmm.
on what I don't like, on what always has been, on what I find painful, on suffering, on disease? Am I putting my attention there? Because if what we think about is what expands, and if what we think about is what we create our world out of, and our thoughts are on what we don't like, or what's wrong, or what's missing, then we will attract more of what's wrong, or what's missing, or what we don't like, or what always has been, even if we despise it, even if it's something that we're very upset about. It's a matter of learning how to put our attention, it's not even a reframing thing as much as putting our attention on what we intend to manifest at this moment in our life. And when we do that, when we put our attention on that, then we act upon what we, what our thoughts are, and we attract more of it rather than attracting more of what we don't want. One of the reasons most people are not good at manifesting or attracting into their life what they want or solving problems is because their thoughts are always on what's wrong, and on what's missing, and on the problem. Maslow taught me years and years ago that when you're working with a patient, never let them spend more than a few moments on the problem, because what you think about is what expands, and if they're talking about the problem all the time, when they leave your session, that problem will expand.
Uh-huh.
But get them to put their attention on what they intend to create, or on solutions.
Doesn't this involve also on a deeper level drilling down to the essence of reinventing your worldview, because the way you look at the world and God influences your thoughts and actions, and by shifting how you approach the world, that shifts your thoughts and actions in a more positive way?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it is. It is. Hold on one second.
Uh-huh.
Oh, no, it's fine. It's fine. Sorry. I call it rewriting your agreement with reality.
Yeah, yeah.
It's making a new commitment to what your world is going to be and how connected you are going to be to your source and to God and to a higher energy or whatever you want to call it. And knowing that you can call upon that at any given moment in your life.
And then if you make that shift, then your thoughts and actions in turn, like dominoes, change.
Exactly. And then you start, it's like the law of attraction, then you start attracting more of what you want into your life instead of what you don't want.
Mm-hmm.
Or instead of what always has been. I always think that the highest functioning people, they never even put their energy on what is. If they don't like what is, you don't think about what is, you think about what you intend to create.
Okay.
And there's a big difference between, because most people who have a lot of poor problems in their life are constantly talking about them, are focused on them, and thinking about what's wrong and the circumstances of their life that they don't like, and they just keep attracting more of those circumstances because that's where their thoughts are.
And isn't it also important to recognize that it doesn't matter how long they've had the problems, it doesn't matter how long a room has been dark, when you switch on the light, it's light.
Exactly. It has nothing to do with it. I always say, if you put your thoughts on what always has been, then you'll continue to attract what always has been, even though you despise what always has been.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't matter how long what always has been has existed. Once you put your attention, your thoughts, your energy, your consciousness on a new intention. And the word intention, I think, is really important, because it doesn't leave any room for doubt. It doesn't leave any room for maneuvering. I intend to create this in my life out of the circumstances that I'm now experiencing.
So intention and attention.
Right, intention and attention, right.
Isn't it also important then, instead of worrying about having what you want, wanting what you have?
That's a very good point, yeah, because if your thoughts are always on what you want, then you're going to still be in a state of wanting. So it's like, that's why I say you put your attention not on what you want so much as what you intend to create, or what you intend to manifest, and also being in a state of gratitude. And Rumi once said, sell your cleverness and purchase bewilderment.
Ah.
And I think being in a state of bewilderment is really being in a state of gratitude.
How so? Bewilderment.
How so?
Yes. What does bewilderment bring to you?
It just puts you in a sense of awe. It gives you a sense of appreciation.
Uh-huh.
There's two. The lowest energy that you can have is the energy of depreciation. And the highest energy you can have is the energy of appreciation.
Uh-huh.
So that if you're ever in a moment of depreciation, if you do a kinesthesiological test on a person who's in a state of depreciation, I don't like the weather, I don't like this house, I don't like my children, I don't appreciating your surroundings or your environment, your culture, or whatever, then you will find that in kinesthesiology, you will be weakened from that. If they do a muscle test on you when you're thinking a depreciating thought, it will always weaken you. Whereas if you change that thought to one of appreciation, you know, wherever you are right in this moment, you can look around and find, you know, hundreds of things to appreciate. Or you can be, like so many people in the world, looking for occasions to be offended. And when you're a person who's looking for an occasion to be offended, you're almost never disappointed. There's always somebody that you're not going to like, or something that you're going to be disapprove of, or something you don't agree with, or whatever, and you'll be constantly in that state of depreciating, and constantly be weakened.
And now that's really what you mean by the phrase creating your own reality?
Rewriting your agreement with reality.
Uh-huh.
It's just creating, just having a new agreement. I'm going to appreciate today rather than depreciate.
So this also involves them being fully present and calling your energy back from depreciating thoughts about maybe past hurts.
Yeah, it means recognizing that past hurts. If you bond yourself to those wounds of your past, then those will become your calling cards. Those will be the things that you'll put out there into the world, and you'll just continue to attract more of what it is that caused those hurts in the first place.
So, how important is forgiveness?
Forgiveness is the essence of virtually every civilized religion in the world. It's the message of every great spiritual master who's ever walked on this planet, including Jesus. You know, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And I'd always like Mark Twain's observation about forgiveness. He said, "Forgiveness is the fragrance that the violet sheds on the heel that has crushed it." And it's the idea of being able to send. Again, it goes back to that prayer of St. Francis. It goes back to a spiritual solution to every problem. Where there is hatred, let me sow love. When you bring love to the presence of hatred, no matter what, at any moment, hatred cannot survive. And hatred is one of the causes of most of our the problems that people face, emotional problems that people face.
But forgiveness is a tall order for a lot of people. Isn't perhaps a better way to put that is release?
Well, however, whatever term you want to use to describe letting go, and no longer hanging on to detaching, you know, from all of the things that you believe should have happened or shouldn't have happened. I look at my past. I had a father who walked out on me when I was an infant.
Uh-huh.
Never made a phone call. Never looked back. Died of cirrhosis of the liver. Spent years in prison. Was basically a very abusive man in almost every way, and certainly irresponsible. And I look upon his role in my life as one of the most important people in my life. And it wasn't until I was able to get rid of my anger and hatred toward him and forgive him that I was able to get off of the path of self-destruction.
How do you choose love over fear? Is it as simple as making a simple choice?
You just fake it until you make it.
Okay.
They say, you know, there's a book called, Susan Jeffers, Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway.
Yes, I've heard that.
You know, and it isn't the idea that, that courage is, that people who have courage don't have any fears. You know, it's that people who have fears face their fears. That's the difference. That's what courage really is. It's like you have it, you experience it, you know it, and you look it right in the face, and you walk right into it, and you don't run away from it, and you don't blame it on somebody else. So that true nobility isn't really about being better than anybody else. It's just about being better than you used to be. It's just about challenging something that you used to give into, and not allowing yourself, not telling yourself that, you know, until I get rid of all my fears, will I be a self-actualized person? You'll never get rid of the fears, but you'll come to a place where you're willing to face them.
That quote, courage is fear that said its prayers.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, Dorothy Bernard.
Yeah.
That's good. So when your seminar in April will focus on everything that we've been talking about then.
Well, there's two things. I have a PBS special that'll be airing. In fact, it'll be airing there in Minneapolis in March.
Okay.
It was recorded out in Concord at the First Parish where Ralph Waldo Emerson's grandfather was the minister. And we recorded it on the old North Bridge, you know, where
the way, intuitive healing is the theme of this issue that this will be printed in.
Mm-hmm.
And health challenges for a lot of people are the biggest problem in their lives. How can a spiritual approach to healing help overcome health problems?
Well, you know, they say that the people who calibrate at the very highest energy levels, you know, that when you would walk into their presence, just being in their energy field, everything that is diseased or in disharmony is healed. That when you bring a higher and a faster and a more loving energy to the presence of whatever it is that you are experiencing, called disorder or disharmony or disease, you are really bringing a healing energy. And that's really what healing is involved with. It's in no longer allowing yourself to wallow around in a process in your body in which you tell yourself that I don't have the capacity to be able to transcend what it is that is that is bothering me, or that is hurting me, or that is killing me, or whatever. And that, you know, I take total responsibility for what I have without any guilt, even if it's cancer or arthritis or, you know, whatever it might be. I take responsibility for it. And I'm going to bring as much higher and faster energy as I possibly can. I'm going to dissociate myself from identifying myself as this body that might have some things that are going on that are incompatible with perfect health. And as you detach from it and get outside of it, you have much more of an opportunity to send love to it and divine energy and even miracles, which can occur when you're in that state of detachment.
Can you explain the difference then being responsible to your illness but not for it?
Yeah, it simply means that I don't choose guilt. Being responsible for it means that I somehow believe that I'm being punished, you know, for having done bad things or having, you know, been an irresponsible person or whatever, and this is my form of punishment. Whereas when you're responsible to it, you simply say, I am, I own this, it's mine. I don't understand perhaps why I got it or whatever it is that created it in my body, but I'm taking total and complete responsibility for it. And the reason for that is that if you believe that any illness that you have or any disease that you might have in your life is the result of something or someone outside of yourself that you have no control over, then in order for it to go away, you have to wait for something outside of yourself to change, and you have absolutely almost no chance of healing. Whereas if you take total responsibility for it and say, look, I've got this, I own it, it's mine, I'm not being punished, it's just something that is a condition of my life, but I'm the one who's taking responsibility for it, then there's something within you that has to change in order to help make it better, and now you're in charge rather than something outside of you is.
And that's getting back to the original concept of, hey, this isn't a problem in the first place.
That's right. That's right. It's just a condition that I'm dealing with, and I'm dealing with it from a non-guilty perspective.
Now, also, can you talk about shifting from a belief system to a knowing and for healing?
Yeah, I've talked about that in other places in my books and so on. And, you know, a belief is something that generally comes to us from outside of ourselves. Again, it's the culture that we're immersed in. It's the people that raised us. It's the books that we've read. It's all of the forces that have been impinging upon us in order to get us to change or to be what they think we should be. Whereas a knowing is something that comes from within. You know, a knowing, like knowing how to swim, doesn't come from somebody else showing you or someone else telling you or watching movies of other people swimming. It comes from having been in the water, knowing how to move yourself through the water and not think. And that's true of virtually everything in our lives.
Uh-huh.
Knowing comes from direct experience. And I think there's a difference between knowing God and knowing about God.
Uh-huh.
And knowing about God is all of the stuff that we have been told and all of the books that we've read and all of our religious experiences and all of that we've tried to convince us of. But knowing God is when we make conscious contact.
Uh-huh.
And that's why making conscious contact was such an important part of the healing.
Oh, excuse me, that's my headset. Okay, well, I know in the How to Get What You Really, Really, Really Want tape, you talked about in the healing world, when a knowing confronts a belief in a disease process, the knowing will always triumph.
Right.
And you said it takes an abandonment and tribal consciousness to get to a place where you can say, I know I can heal myself.
Right. Yeah.
So until you get to that place...
Until And that means that that's a banishment of all doubt.
Uh-huh.
A banishing of doubt.
That's the first step somebody can take. If they say, I want to get to that place.
Well, I think the first step always is to turn it over to, turn your life over and turn your problem, turn your struggle over to making conscious contact with God, turning it over to God. In other words, saying, I am connected to God, and I am going to turn this thing over. I don't know how to deal with it myself. And I get quiet, I get peaceful, and I meditate. And I think meditation isn't just something we do to make ourselves more peaceful and to take some of the stress out of our lives. We do it because it's the only direct experience we can have of knowing God. Because God is that which is indivisible. Everything else in the universe, in the physical world, is divisible. Up and down, good and bad, right and wrong, male and female, and so on, east and west, on earth and death and all of that. But that which is indivisible in our physical experience is called silence. And when you get into silence, you're coming to know the indivisibleness of your life. That's conscious contact. That's the first and I think the major step that we need to take.
Is that what you refer to as CD consciousness or unity consciousness?
Yes, when you finally make that conscious contact and you know that you and God are one, that I am in you and you are in me, and I am in the Father and the Father is in you, that there's no separation there. In the Book of Miracles, it also says that if you do have a problem, you only have one. And that problem, that one problem you have is your belief that you are separate from God.
Okay. And with CD consciousness, how do you spell CD?
SIDDHI, CD.
DDHI, okay. And on a bigger picture, too, you talked about just being more loving and positive and putting that energy out. Doesn't that also then help the world at large? Because as Deepak says, that strengthens the unified field.
Absolutely. Because everything is connected. And those who live at the very highest and the fastest energies are able to compensate for people who live at very low and slow energies. They say that on a scale of 1 to 1,000, with 1,000 representing divine unity consciousness and 0 or 1 representing the lowest energy that we have, that one person at 1,000, such as Jesus Christ, walking among us, would counterbalance the negativity of everybody else on the planet. And one person at 900 can counterbalance the negative energy of, say, 90 million people underneath them. The people that represent the highest and the fastest and spiritual energies among us are literally, without them, all of humanity would self-destruct.
That's wonderful.
Negativity, yeah. There's a wonderful book about this. It's called The Power Versus Force by David Hawkins. He's a medical doctor.
Oh, okay.
And it's also, he's got a new one called The Eye of the Eye, the EYE of the Eye. And he talks a lot about the counterbalancing effect of higher energies on people who continue at very low energies.
Oh, that's very inspiring.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful reading.
Now, is this unity consciousness more easily adopted, perhaps, by very, very young people? For example, I'm thinking of the story of Sage's Bumps.
Oh, yeah. That story, by the way, is in the new book. I mean, the actual letter that she wrote about it is in there. I don't think it has anything to do with age.
Okay.
I think some people show up here at very high levels of consciousness, and some of us struggle for it for our whole lifetime, and some never get never get past shame and guilt and so on. I don't think it has anything to do with age. Although I do think younger people who haven't been conditioned have more of a sense of their own ability to perform their own.
Can you tell me very briefly that story of Sage?
Yeah, it's in the book, by the way. I'm going to have a book sent to you. So it's,
okay.
I think it's on page 97 or 98. Her whole letter, everything is all in there.
I have the tape, too, when you talk about it, but just for the purpose of this interview, I just wanted to.
Yeah, it's just what she had was a series of what we call flat warts on her face for about 3.5-4 years, and we went to a dermatologist, and he talked to her and told her that the best way he knew for getting rid of them was to talk to them. And because he didn't want to burn them off, and he didn't want to do anything that would disfigure her. And she went in, she'd had them for 3.5 years, and she talked to her bumps for 3 nights in a row, and they disappeared from Monday to Friday. And they've never returned. Her skin has always been perfect.
And that was when she was 7?
She was 7, yeah.
How old is she now?
She's
mentioned before, you grew up in an orphanage and foster homes.
Yes.
How did that shape you in terms of bringing to you to where you are now?
Well, I think it's everything that we go through in our life, we have to go through. And I believe that my purpose in life was to really teach self-reliance. And so I had the experience relying on myself very early in my life in order to have the knowing. Because otherwise, I would have just read about it.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have that, and I always think of it as a great advantage that I had.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly taught me to rely upon myself at very young, and that's what I've been teaching since I was a little boy.
Was that the greatest challenge you've ever had in your life, growing up?
Not really. It wasn't that much of a challenge. When you're an orphan, you don't wake up every day and tell yourself, I'm an orphan again today, why did this happen to me? You just get on with your life. No, I don't think that was the greatest challenge of my life. I've had other challenges. Nothing much greater than that.
What has been your greatest challenge?
Well, I've had addictions in my life that I've had to overcome. I have a sort of an addictive personality, and I've played around with alcohol and drugs, and I played around with caffeine, did a lot of that kind of stuff in my life, and drank beer a lot, and was overweight for a while, and those kinds of challenges I've been through. The challenge of divorce, that's a very powerful challenge in my life.
What steps allowed you to overcome the addiction and divorce?
Getting closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling that that my challenges were not between me and an addiction, or between me and my ex-wife, or between me and anyone. They're really between me and God. Can I bring love and peace to the presence of those challenges and not get down on myself and not get down on someone else? And as I was able to do that, I've been able to come. I had a heart attack a year and a half ago, and I wrote about that in the new book.
Uh-huh.
And that was another great challenge.
I know that spirituality is, of course, a gradual lifetime process. Do you remember how old you were, perhaps, when you finally started to get it and start to awaken?
I think it's an evolutionary thing. I mean,
right.
When I started in my professional life, it was when I started writing a book called You'll See It When You Believe It.
Uh-huh.
Which was really, I represented a major shift away from psychology and towards spirituality in my writing. But as I look back on my earlier writings, with Erroneous Zones and Pulling Around Strings and books like that, there's a lot of spirituality in it. I just didn't call it that.
Uh-huh.
And I've always had a knowing that being kind is a lot more effective than being angry. And being generous has always been a characteristic I've had. Whatever I had, I've always been willing to give away.
Uh-huh.
And those are spiritual qualities.
So when you said that, to get to know God better, was there a moment in your life when the bell went off and you realized no?
No, there never was. It was an evolutionary process. I wrote about it, and you'll see when you believe it, when I went to my father's grave and I was able to forgive my father. That was a very key moment in my life. But I mean, one of the moments happened in a meditation. And I just started practicing meditation. It was, and as I practiced meditation, I got to, I had an experience of, an inner experience of knowing God.
Uh-huh.
Another time when I was giving up drinking, I had a real clear sense in my mind that this wasn't something that I was going to continue to do any longer. And I had a feeling of a presence. I was in a dream almost, and it was like looking through a window that someone had put special Windex on that I could see right through it for thousands of miles. And all I could see was pure infinity and pure love, and that it would be easy, not hard, and it was. Wonderful.
Well, the last question I have, editor wanted me to ask, is going back to the spiritual solution to every problem, how can we look at the situation in New York City and Afghanistan and find a spiritual solution to help us resolve it?
Well, you have to recognize what the problem is. You know, the problem is, if you go back to if you go back to 1775, everybody in America was told to hate the English. That we would have bitter hatred toward them. All you have to do is go look at The Patriot or one of those kind of movies and see how much hatred there was for the British. 30 years later, we were allies with the British, and we hated the French. America hated the Spanish, bitterly. And 20 years after that, we hated the Germans. And then 25 years later, we hated the Japanese. And then we hated the Russians for a very long time. And then the Iranians, and then the Iraqis, and now it's the Taliban. And who we're supposed to hate, the faces of hatred just keep changing. See, the problem isn't who we hate. The problem is hatred itself. That all of this stuff passes, but hatred is the lowest, slowest energy that human beings can live under. And when we have too much of it in the world, we begin to see that, it becomes very, very, very destructive, and then we react. The problem with using force in our lives is that we always create a counterforce. So that if you're with a child, and a child says, I hate you, which is a very low energy, and you respond with, I hate you too, you have lowered the collective energy that you both are in, and both of you will be weakened. Whereas if you respond to, I hate you with love, which is what instinctively we know what to do, then we can dissolve and dissipate that hatred. And until we as collectively learn how to respond to each other's hatreds with love, which is what Jesus taught us, which is what Buddha came here to teach us, which is what Muhammad taught us, which is what all of the great spiritual masters who have ever walked among us, who live at those highest energies, taught us, until we learn that responding to force with more force just creates more problems. And ultimately, I think that's what we will learn. In the meantime, we have to look at the people who want to tear our buildings down as like a cancer in a body called humanity. And we have to go through and isolate and remove those cancer cells. One of the ways, the new ways that they're learning to deal even with cancer is that they surround the adjacent cells with high doses of very high energy through lasers and so on. And just the presence of that higher energy around those cancer cells has a tendency to dissolve it. It might be the healing that the cure for cancer that we've been looking for so long. And that's what we have to do. I think we have to isolate and remove those that would behave in those ways. But we have to also remember that we have to ask ourselves, why do we attract so much hatred in our world? Why does America attract so much of that? And how much of it are we putting out into the world? You know, how much are we exporting violence? How many guns do we produce? How many nuclear weapons do we produce? What do we do with all of our wealth and so on? Why aren't we better at exporting what good people we are rather than at how different we are and how intolerant we are of the way other people are? That's what we have to look at. We have to look at it collectively. I talked a lot about this on the media.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you so much. This is absolutely wonderful.
You're very welcome. Let me get your address.
Okay.
I'll have a copy of Spiritual Solutions sent on to you tomorrow.
It's wonderful.
Wait a minute. Let me just get something to write on here.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Phil, P-H-I-L,
mm-hmm.
Ballista, B as in bank, O-L-S-T-A,
mm-hmm.
3145,
mm-hmm.
Harbor Lane North, H-A-R-B-O-R,
mm-hmm.
Apartment 1-...
Harbor Lane?
Yes, Harbor Lane North.
North, yeah.
Apartment 1-212.
1-212.
In Plymouth, Minnesota. 55447.
Do you have photos? Do you need to have photos or anything like that, or do you have that?
The editor said nothing about photos, so I'm sure that he's got them.
Okay. I'll have a copy of it sent off to you.
Wonderful. I look forward to seeing you when you get here.
I look forward to it, too.
Thank you again.
Thank you.
And I'll send you information about that other article.
Okay.